The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ann Jordan for the North Carolina Reading Service, and welcome to Oprah Magazine. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah.com. This first article is in the Inspiration section. Elizabeth Gilbert admits, "I need a dose of courage every day." She's a memoirist, novelist, and world traveler. Elizabeth Gilbert's Eat, Pray, Love, a chronicle of her post-divorce adventures in Italy, India, and Bali, became an iconic travel memoir not for its incredible scenes, transcendent experiences, and fascinating characters, although it does have all of those things, but because the story began in a place where many of her readers have found themselves, kneeling on the bathroom floor in crisis. Gilbert's account of making peace with the past and discovering her more authentic self gave women an example of another kind of hero's journey, one in which the treasure at the end of the quest is a more truthful life. Eat, Pray, Love fans have told Gilbert that the book inspired them to begin or end romances, to embrace motherhood or eschew it, to change their job or their address or their beliefs. These radical shifts, she says, like any profound transformation, don't necessarily have anything to do with planes, trains, or automobiles. I have a painting of Emily Dickinson, who spent much of her life in her bedroom, but still created some of the most monumental poetry ever written, she says. That painting reminds me that the answers to my life are not likely to be found out there. The world is an enchanting place, but there are worlds inside us, too, that are always ready to be unlocked. In her subsequent books, such as Big Magic, A How-To for Cultivating Creative Expression, and The Signature of All Things, the story of the fictional 19th century botanist Alma Whitaker, Gilbert has remained an intrepid explorer of intellectual and emotional terrain. She's also spent the past few years navigating challenging personal territory, caring for and then grieving for her partner, Rhea Elias, who died of cancer on January 2018. "I can't live without her, so I don't," Gilbert says. "Sometimes I make a recording into my phone and just talk to her. The fact that the message is being recorded makes me feel like she's receiving it." Despite Gilbert's trademark blend of lightness and earnestness, common sense and magical realism, she says her equanimity doesn't come easily. "I need a dose of courage every day because I'm frightened every day. There will always be a little nervous person inside me. But if there's a creative project I'm afraid to attempt, a truth I need to tell, or a painful new reality I must face, I ask myself, what's the alternative?" And here we have 20 questions for Elizabeth Gilbert. Number one, what is your no-fail, go-for-it motivational song? And she says, "Get Up Off of That Thing" by James Brown. When James Brown tells you to get up, you'd best get up. Number two, what's the most important for your mental health? "Every day I write myself a letter from love, divine, unconditional love. I ask for advice, and love always gives me kind answers, which I write down as they come to me. Even in my darkest hours, love has shown up, saying, 'I'm right here. I've got you. You're never alone.'" Number three, what is the physical challenge that scares you most? "Anything that involves getting in the path of powerful ocean waves." Number four, what's the one mystery that you'd most love to solve? She says, "How much control do we humans have over our behavior and personality? Can we change our nature? Or are we all just victims of our brain chemistry, genetics, hormones, and upbringing?" Number five, who's your hero? Sister Mary Scullion of Project Home in Philadelphia, a wonderful Catholic nun who has devoted her life to providing housing, education, medical care, and dignity to homeless people in her native city. Number six, if you could send a note to yourself in 2030, what would it say? "Please forgive me for all the stuff I did wrong in the 2020s. I was doing my best, but life had more lessons to teach me." Number seven, what makes you laugh? She says, "The same thing that makes everyone else laugh. Pets riding Roombas." Number eight, what makes you cry? "Sad movies on airplanes. At times I've cried so hard the flight attendants were worried." Number nine, what gives you hope? "The changing demographics of America, I'm praying that young people and the newest arrivals to our country will save us. Number 10, what's your favorite place on earth? She says, any long white sand beach with a cool artsy town nearby. New York's Fire Island is pretty perfect, and so is Byron Bay, Australia. Number 11, fill in the blank. Blank is underrated. She says, aging. Youth is so much more painful than middle age. I wouldn't be 20 years again for anything in the world, not even for the nice smooth neck. Number 12, what would you love to invent? A machine that turns ocean plastic into healthy plankton for whales to eat. Number 13, when in your life have you needed courage? She says, the time when I took care of Rhea as she was dying. We entered our romantic relationship shortly after her cancer diagnosis, so I knew we have a very brief time together. But when I put my entire heart on the line, I'm just so happy I did. Number 14, what movie could you watch on an endless loop? The Big Lebowski. Number 15, if you could choose any magical power, what would it be? Always knowing exactly the right thing to say. That's not too much to ask, is it? Number 16, if you were creating a time capsule to be opened in 100 years, what would you put inside? A note of congratulations to humanity for still being here. Good job, guys. We weren't sure you could pull it off. Number 17, what's your pettiest pet peeve? She says people who say nipped it in the butt instead of nipped it in the bud. In the grand scheme of things, how could this matter? But somehow I care. Number 18, how do you define soulmate? She says cautiously, in the past, this term and my eagerness to believe in it has led me to self-abandonment, misjudgment, super inflated expectations, and heartbreak. From now on, let's just start by being friends. Number 19, what's the greatest gift we can give each other? Mercy. Number 20, what's the greatest gift we can give ourselves? Mercy. Okay, and here's another article called A Definitive Timeline of Dolly Parton and Carl Dean's Enduring Relationship. The couple has been married for 54 years. This article was published on September 25th, 2020. And the photo shows Carl Dean giving Dolly Parton a kiss on the cheek, and she is smiling and looking at the camera, and she is wearing a denim shirt and hoop earrings. Though Dolly Parton, 74, is responsible for penning some of the greatest love songs of all time, including the 1973 hit I Will Always Love You, Parton and her husband Carl Thomas Dean, 78, keep their relationship extremely private. Rarely are the couple, who have been together since 1964, photographed or interviewed together. Yet that may just be the secret that keeps their romance strong. In a 2020 interview with People, Parton, who has an upcoming Netflix special, Christmas on the Square, gave a rare insight into her married life. After 56 years together, Parton says she and Dean keep the spark alive by planning spontaneous but simple dates for one another. I'll cook the stuff that I know we love, and I pack it up in a picnic blanket, and then we'll go find some riverbank somewhere with our little camper, park, and have a picnic. Or we'll pull up to some little Days Inn motel, go in as long as the bed's clean and there's a bathroom. We just do our little things like that, Parton told People. According to Parton, Dean always thinks of ways to make her feel special. In the springtime, when the first daffodils come out, my husband always brings me a bouquet. And he'll usually write me a little poem, which to me, that's priceless. That's like a date in itself, Parton told People. Here's a look back at how Dean swept her off her cowboy-booted feet 5 decades ago. Spoiler meet-cute alert, it all began at the laundromat. 1964. It was love at first sight for Parton and Dean when they met outside the wishy-washy laundromat in Nashville. She was 18 and he was 21. It was Parton's first day in the Music City, having just moved from her native Sevierville, Tennessee. Parton caught Dean's eye as he drove by in his white pickup truck. Sounds like the makings of a country song, right? My first thought was, I'm gonna marry that girl, Dean shared when they renewed their vows at their 50th wedding anniversary celebration in 2016. My second thought was, Lord, she's good looking. And that was the day my life began. While she tended to be fluffing and folding, he reportedly flirted with her. When I met my husband, he wanted to take me out to dinner, Parton told People about their first few years of dating. He pulled up to the drive-in window and got our food at McDonald's. He only likes to go places where he can be comfortable. There's a black and white photo here of when Dolly and Dean were first dating. She's got blonde hair up in a big bouffant, and she's wearing a pleated skirt that comes about to her knees, and she's wearing a cardigan with white buttons and a white lace collar. And Dean is dressed in a suit with a skinny tie. 1996. Then 2 years later, on May 30th, 1966, Parton and Dean made it official, tying the knot at a church in Ringgold, Georgia. She was 20, and he was 23. The only people in attendance were Parton's mom, Avie Lee, and the preacher and his wife. Back in 1966, Parton had just gotten her big break by singing the demo, Put It Off Until Tomorrow, for country music artist Bill Phillips, and her first solo hit, Dumb Blonde, was gaining momentum on the music charts. Parton and Dean decided to elope because her record label, Monument, was worried that Parton getting hitched would get in the way of her music career. According to People, the record label wanted her to think about it, and Parton, in typical Southern fashion, responded, I ain't waiting. My mother made me a little white dress and a little bouquet, Parton told Country Music Television, or CMT. But I said, I can't get married in a courthouse because I'll never feel married. So we found a little Baptist church in town, and we went up to Pastor Don Duvall and said, would you marry us? We got pictures on the steps right outside the church. 1966, though Parton was on the fast track to becoming the legendary country music artist she's revered as today, her husband, who runs a local asphalt paving company in Nashville, chose to stay out of the spotlight. Parton recounted a BMI dinner in 1966, which was the first and last industry event she and her husband attended together. Parton was honored with the Songwriting Award for the Phillips recording of Put It Off Until Tomorrow. But when the night's festivities were over, Dean made it clear that he wanted nothing to do with the entertainment business. This was my first big record, remembered Parton. It went up to number one for Bill, and it was BMI's Song of the Year. So Carl and I got dressed up, he was in a tux, and we drove to the dinner. We got out and walked up the red carpet and went inside and sat through the dinner and the awards. After the dinner, Carl turned to me and said, Dolly, I want you to have everything you want, and I'm happy for you, but don't you ever ask me to go to another one of them dang things again. However, Parton credits their difference to the success of their 5-decades-long relationship. They say opposites attract, and it's true, she told People in 2015. We were completely opposite, but that's what makes it fun. I never know what he's going to say or do. He's always surprising me. Parton added, he wants to mostly be around the house. He knows that I'm just the opposite. I can't go enough places. I can't do enough things. He loves that. He's independent. He doesn't need me in his face, and it's the same with me. But when we're together, we do have enough things in common that it works. 1973. In 1973, Parton released the hit song Jolene that would, 1 year later, become the title of her 14th studio album. On the track, Parton sings about confronting a young red-haired woman named Jolene, who she believes is sleeping around with her husband. It's one of her most beloved songs, and along with the success of it came speculation that the lyrics hit a little too close to home. Parton herself fanned the flames of cheating rumors, telling fans at her earlier concerts that she put a stop to Dean spending so much at the bank where Jolene apparently worked. However, in recent years, Parton has revealed that the real Jolene is actually a little girl with red hair, green eyes, and fair skin who she met at one of her shows. When the young woman asked for an autograph and told Parton her name, Parton, according to The Independent, said it was just about the prettiest name she ever heard. And she promised Jolene she would write a song about her. We're not sure which Jolene story is true. Parton dedicated the ode From Here to the Moon and Back to her husband. The song originally appeared on Parton's Joyful Noise soundtrack album to coincide with the musical film of the same name. She later recorded the track as a duet with frequent collaborator Willie Nelson. I needed to write a beautiful love song, she recalled during an interview with The Boot. I picked my husband, who I love, and I thought, well, I'll write some beautiful song about him. It was about my husband in the movie played by Kris Kristofferson, so I thought in order to make it really real and really touching, I would write my real true emotions about someone I really do love and have loved for more than half of my life. 2016. The longtime couple renewed their vows in May 2016, marking their 50th anniversary. Because Parton didn't get the wedding she dreamed of back in 1966, the 9-to-5 singer pulled out all the stops for her intimate renewal ceremony at their home in Nashville. "I got all dressed up in the most beautiful gown you've ever seen and dressed that husband of mine up," Parton told Rolling Stone. "He looked like a handsome dude out of Hollywood. We had a few family and friends around. We didn't plan anything big at all because we didn't want any kind of strain, any kind of tension, any kind of commotion. So we planned it cleverly and carefully. We just had a simple little ceremony at our chapel at our place. We just had fun with it. If I had to do it all over, I'd do it all over again, and we did," Parton said back in 2016. "I'm dragging him kicking and screaming into the next 50 years. Later, in 2016, Dean served as the inspiration for Parton's 46th studio album. Yes, you heard that right, which was released on August 19th. "I was just trying to think about all of the different colors of love through the years," Parton explained during her Rolling Stone interview. "I thought, well, I'm going to write about mine and Carl's relationship. It's just a pure and simple relationship." So it started with that. And then I thought, well, why don't I write a whole album of love songs? 2018. The couple does not have children, but Parton and Dean enjoy spoiling their nieces and Parton's famous goddaughter, Miley Cyrus. She continues to work with kids through her nonprofit organization, Dolly Parton's Imagination Library, as well. And here's a photo of Dolly and Carl and a dog. And it's a spotted dog. It looks like maybe a bulldog. She's also busy these days with music and the confirmed 9-to-5 film reboot. And Parton released the soundtrack for Netflix's original film Dumplin', starring Jennifer Aniston last year. The album features 6 new songs and 6 reimagined oldie but goodies. Continuing her partnership with a streaming giant, Parton executive produced an 8-part anthology series called Dolly Parton's Heartstrings that's based on her music. Each episode will have a different theme song and cast. And of course, one will include Jolene. 2019. Parton admitted that Dean's not necessarily one of the biggest fans of my music. She told Good Morning Britain host Kate Garraway, "He likes hard rock. He likes Led Zeppelin and bluegrass music, so my music is somewhere in between. He doesn't dislike it, but he doesn't go out of his way to play my records, let's put it that way." Still, Parton said that Dean has always supported her in his own way. "He's proud of me," she said, "and he loves that I love what I do. I think it's just a touchy subject. I'm like his little girl, I think. He just worries about that," adding that Dean will show up to her performances at state fairs because he loves to go to the tractor pull. "For years and years, he would never come to the shows because he felt like he'd get nervous if I messed up, so he never wanted to watch it," Parton said. "The first time he saw me perform and that I was in control of the stage, he was okay." Okay, here's another article called "Oprah Urges You to Vote as If Your Life Depended on It." On National Voter Registration Day, Oprah posted a video on Instagram explaining why it's so important that people exercise their right to vote in the 2020 election. For Oprah, democracy is not a spectator sport. On September 22nd, National Voter Registration Day, Lady O posted a video on Instagram encouraging her followers to vote while explaining what's at stake in the 2020 presidential election. "In a lifetime of interviewing people, I learned that the most important question we can ask ourselves is, what do I want?" said Oprah at the start of the video. "That question is necessary for setting the vision for your personal life. It is also vital in the collective vision of our country. What do we want?" Wearing a sweater with the word "vote" emblazoned on it, O of O explained the power of voting in America. "Voting is a giant step in the direction of the collective vision we hold for our country," she noted. "This 2020 election holds the highest stakes we've known for our democracy in our lifetime. Life as we know and hope for it to be is on the line, I believe." Oprah continued, "What we need now more than ever is discernment, the ability to perceive and judge well, to recognize what is happening in plain sight. The divisiveness, the racial collisions, the hot spots of COVID that continually resurge, the death toll that we've now all normalized, all of it is a mirror, trying to force us to look more closely at what we human beings are doing to each other and get us to ask the question, what do I want?" In particular, Oprah emphasized that voting is the ultimate way to make your voice heard. We can pray, We can protest, all good in a democracy of choices, she said. But the only way to have a voice in moving yourself and our country forward is to vote. Every vote matters because you matter. Vote as if your life depended on it, because trust, it does. Oprah has previously demonstrated her commitment to getting some more people to the polls. In 2018, she teamed up with her longtime friend Maria Shriver, who is the former First Lady of California, to encourage people to vote in the midterm election, and she even went door-to-door canvassing on behalf of gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams. More recently, in August 2020, she announced that Election Day would be a paid company-wide holiday for all of the Oprah Winfrey Network employees so that they can vote or volunteer. To register to vote, request a mail-in ballot, or check your registration status, go to https://nationalvoterregistrationday.org. That's https://nationalvoterregistrationday.org. This next article is from the fitness section, 4 Ways to Get or Stay Motivated to Exercise. Personal trainer Massey Arias knows that a fit body starts with the right attitude. No matter your workout goals, keep your head in the game with her top motivational tips. Number 1, go deep. Instead of just worrying about shrinking belly fat or building up your biceps, focus on what really matters to you. Arias looks to her 16-month-old daughter for fitness inspiration. I want a clear mind, to feel energized, and to be there for her, she says. Finding your emotional impetus is a more effective incentive than focusing on appearance for sticking with your routine long term. Number 2, open your mind. Barring serious health issues, you're never too stiff, too slow, or too old to try a workout, says Arias. Go into your activity of choice without preconceived notions of what it's supposed to be like. Give yourself a chance, and you'll be surprised at how your body can adapt, she says. It's never too late, even if you're starting from zero. Number 3, think small. There's nothing wrong with big goals, but you're more likely to succeed if you break them down into increments that work for your lifestyle, age, and ability level, says Arias. For example, if you can jog a mile in 15 minutes, first aim to shave 30 seconds off of your pace rather than focusing on a 10-minute finish. Small victories along your journey will give you a sense of accomplishment that will fuel your fire. Number 4, mix it up. Arias says she'll attempt any and every type of workout, from boot camp to acro yoga. Why? Experimenting staves off boredom. And trying a new class or activity can also help with accountability. You have an opportunity to make friends who may expect you to show up, she says, and when someone else is relying on you for motivation, it's a lot easier to stay motivated yourself. All right, this next article is called 6 Mantras That Have Gotten Me Through Life's Biggest Changes. A life coach and author shares the words that help her navigate difficult and uncertain times, by Susie Moore. Anyone who's anyone. When I got divorced at age 23, it was terrifying. I was a 20-something with an ex-husband. I felt like damaged, used goods. I was embarrassed for my poor judgment and failure at a marriage. And don't get me started about my fear of telling potential new dates that I was a divorcee. It felt totally weird and unsexy. The only way I could mentally turn it around was to remind myself of how utterly not alone I was. I chose to focus on how I was one of a million women in the same situation, and certainly not the first with a broken heart. Feeling that connection soothed me. It reminded me of my most loving and compassionate self, and the person whom I wanted to show up as more often. Because connection is the most comforting feeling when you're newly single, scared, and all you want to do is shut down. After all, divorce happens to the best of us, even with our most loving intentions. So I started saying to myself and anyone who asked, anyone who's anyone is divorced, J-Lo, Halle Berry, Kate Winslet. I said it with a laugh and tongue-in-cheek tone, but it actually really helped me, because these strong women were not to be pitied or sympathized with, and neither was I. My dad died of addiction when I was 19. Even in that limited time, he taught me so much and encouraged me more than anyone else. I still miss him terribly. But in my pangs of wishing he were still alive, I remind myself of this truth. Love is stronger than death. Because the truth is, I still have a dad. He lives within my sister and me and shows up in unexpected, even hilarious ways. Like when my husband and I rent a car and out of nowhere, I know how to parallel park, something my dad taught me many years earlier. And when I know how to make the best gravy, as if from some ancient place of remembering, because he taught me that too. I feel his presence and even his pride. My dad was a writer who relished watching me write in my teenage years. So when I held the first book I'd authored in my hands, I felt him say, "Told you so, kiddo." I once heard that moving to a new country is one of the most frightening things a person can undergo. And as someone who's moved around a lot growing up, the UK, Canada, France, Australia, the USA, even as an adult in the face of a one-way ticket and a well-packed suitcase, big nerves bubble up. Especially when you start contemplating all there is to do, new bank, apartment, tax forms, credit, job search, before you even get to the fun stuff, finding some friends, a local yoga studio, the best supermarket, and hey, what if you just don't fit in? The best calming mantra I have found to repeat to people who are going through these similar challenges is, it's all home. We're all in this together. This planet, this life experience, this experiment where we're given 80 years or so if we're lucky. Who cares the name of the city or the country you reside in for a while? In most cases, too, you can always move on. Home is a state of mind, and the sooner you adopt it, the sooner you experience it. Okay, then. Okay, then is not a fancy mantra, and it doesn't have to be. I created this mantra for myself to not dwell on a friend who had let me down. It started when I became single and naturally spent more time around other single people. I was trying to adjust to my new life. She became cold and critical, seeing my going out more as me trying to be an it girl. After a mutual friend told me what she was saying about me behind my back, I confronted her. The pain of her betrayal hurt me, and she wasn't sorry. I knew I wouldn't be able to change her or her behavior, and that was it for our friendship. My final words to her? Okay, then. Because I've learned that when you resist the moment, the situation, the argument, the impossible thing that's happening right now, it only maximizes it. When you let go, surrender, and allow it to just be as it is, you become the most powerful version of yourself. I've also applied this mantra to vocal online haters and to any negative medical report of a loved one of mine receives. Okay, then, what's next? No one knows what they're doing either. When I left my $500,000 job to take my side hustle as a coach full-time, I was scared as hell. The first 2 years of business, I was learning a lot, making mistakes, and in my worst moments, second-guessing myself. I saw other people in my space posting their highlight reels online with hashtags like hashtag crush it and hashtag winning and all the nonsense that just makes you feel bad when you're in a learning phase. Funnily enough, this mantra is my favorite one because it doesn't just apply to business, it applies to everything. I first heard Ricky Gervais say it a few years ago. It resonated so deeply back then and continues to as I coach CEOs, employees of NASA, and high-performing people at all stages. None of us knows what he or she is doing. The most important thing is that we just keep going. We'll figure it out because we're humans, doing the best we can wherever we are. Which leads to my final mantra, the ultimate truth. You are going to be okay. Okay, here's an article called 5 Things You Need to Know Before Quitting Your Job. This is by Farnoosh Torabi. Taking time off from work may sound like a pipe dream, but if you want to make that dream come true, here is what you need to know. Kristen Field was clocking in 12-hour days at a nonprofit when her father died, and she realized she needed a change and fast. "Losing my dad woke me up to the value of the time we have," she says. With 6 months of expenses saved, she quit her job and explored 8 countries, mainly staying at inexpensive hotels and with friends. All told, she took about a year off before returning to work full-time. It may be hard to fathom, especially at this tumultuous moment, but many women are ditching their 9-to-5 to find something more fulfilling. Nearly 3 in 10 highly qualified women report that they've quit their job to take a short break at some point in their career. True, it is a risk. These days, it takes the unemployed roughly 6 to 7 months to land a new job. Yet sometimes the rewards are worth it. Intrigued? Consider the following. Can I afford it? You cannot predict your financial future, but you can minimize your economic burdens. Focus on what's in your control, your spending and your safety net, says Manisha Thakur, Director of Wealth Strategies for Women at the BAM Alliance, a community of wealth management advisors. Analyze your monthly expenses to see where you can cut back. Living frugally while saving up for your leap is great practice for the more modest lifestyle you'll likely have when you're not working. Ideally, you should be able to afford the basics without relying on credit cards or falling behind on bills. Before you quit, make sure you are nodding yes to these statements. I have enough to cover at least 6 months of living expenses. I'm willing to give up extras for a while. Cable, green juices, massages. I can make some money in a pinch, either through side jobs or online, pet sitting, Airbnb-ing, a second bedroom, etc. My debt is under control. Now, what about health insurance? It's imperative. Even if you're in great health, an unexpected illness can saddle you with hefty medical bills, says Thakur. If applicable, COBRA lets you pay to stay on the plan your previous employer provided for up to 18 months. Remember, it'll likely be pricier than what you've been paying since your company won't be covering a percentage of the premium. Alternatively, shop for a plan via your state's marketplace or healthcare.gov while you still can, or visit ehealth.com and healthinsurance.com to explore plans from private insurance brokers. How do I explain the gap in my resume? Pursuing long-postponed goals can be great for your psyche. In some cases, it can also be helpful during job interviews. Employers want to hear that you engaged in experiences that expanded your skill set, says career coach Kathy Caprino. When I was an executive recruiter, says Erica Keswin, who worked with J.P. Morgan, Starbucks, and the NFL, I was always interested in bold people who took risk. Taking time to find your purpose can pay off. There's always a sabbatical. If you need a break but quitting isn't feasible, consider something less final. 28% of companies offer at least some employees paid or unpaid time off, with a guaranteed return to the same or a comparable position. All right, here we have an article called Do Natural Deodorants Really Work? We ask three experts, your stickiest questions answered. There's a whiff of skepticism about whether eco-ingredients can really take care of your underarm issues. We asked the experts for the lowdown. Question, do natural deodorants stop sweat? Answer, not really. In standard antiperspirants, aluminum plugs up glands to stop the drip, but it's missing from natural deodorants. However, you can find products like those from Schmitz or Kaya Naturals that contain activated charcoal. This ingredient can help absorb some moisture, says Paris Carbat, a functional medicine physician at the Cleveland Clinic. Clay may also sop up wetness. Okay, another question. What about odor? Answer. Here again, aluminum is conventional deodorant's main defense. By keeping skin dry, it creates an unappealing environment for bacteria, explains Deanna Glasser, MD, a dermatologist at St. Louis University. And few natural ingredients are as effective at dampness control as aluminum. Instead, some natural products contain baking soda to help neutralize odors. Others have their own pleasant fragrance. Question, are natural deodorants a healthier choice? Answer, the American Cancer Society has determined that there is no link between aluminum and breast cancer. Then again, it's a difficult task to work out what these chemicals do when mixed together and when a woman puts them on her body every day. Says Philippa Darber, PhD, a biochemist at the University of Reading in the UK. She stopped using antiperspirant 20 years ago, she says, and no one walking into my office has complained yet. Here's an article from the inspiration section of Oprah called Think You're Having a Midlife Crisis? Here are some signs to consider. It's not always about buying a flashy red car. Say the words midlife crisis and suddenly a cliche pops into your head. A man in his late 40s or early 50s buying a shiny red sports car to prove to someone, himself probably, that he's still young, hip, and cool. This is mostly thanks to media portrayals of a midlife crisis, as depicted in movies like American Beauty, and even the timeless rom-com Father of the Bride Part 2. As a psychological phenomenon, the midlife crisis became a popular term after a 1984 book by journalist Gail Sheehy called Passages, Predictable Crises of Adult Life, defined as it is an anxiety around the idea of mortality. Basically thinking, is that all there is to life? Sheehy's book posited that men and women both inevitably experience this crisis period, sometime between the ages of 37 and 42. Over time, the definition has expanded, evolved, and changed pretty significantly, including inventing the man buys a sports car has a fair Hollywood version. Nowadays, there's some debate of how common or useful the idea of a midlife crisis even is. So much has changed in our culture that the term has lost much of its meaning, says Vivian Diller, PhD, a psychologist in New York City. This is partly because we live so much longer. It used to be, I have so little time left. Now it's, I have so much time left. Do I want to live this way? Susan Krause Whitburn, a professor emeritus at the University of Massachusetts of Amherst and author of Psychology Today blog, Fulfillment at Any Age, argues against the term entirely. That a more accurate phrase might be ego integrity. This refers to a confrontation with mortality, your sense of meaning in your life, your feeling of purpose, your connection to others, and a concern for your welfare, she says, and it can occur at any age. The cause of a midlife crisis is usually physical aging. As much as the phenomenon does exist, Diller says that for women stereotypically, a midlife crisis is spurred on by seeing the first major physical signs of aging in her body, including graying hair, wrinkles, and most notably, menopause. But it can also be caused by a kind of existential quandary, wondering, what is my purpose? Diller says this might happen when our children are all grown and have left the house, or if our parents don't need to be cared for, and when we need to find new ways to fill our time. You're no longer beholden to the needs of everyone else and are left to finally care for yourself, only to discover that you don't know what makes you feel vital. The age of a midlife crisis often coincides with menopause for women. As Diller mentioned, menopause can come with a major emotional reaction and can even take the form of a midlife crisis. More often than not, the trigger is not being able to have children anymore. That's when you think, I have to start preparing for the next chapter of my life. Though the age of menopause varies greatly, this would put the general range for a female midlife crisis anywhere from 35 to 55, a bit different than Sheehy's guarantee that it will come between 37 and 42. The key sign of a midlife crisis is taking drastic actions. The kind of effects or symptoms that you might see from this idea of midlife crisis really depend on the individual, says Diller. The response can be either a fight or flight, she says. Fighting it would be, I am going to do everything I can possibly to delay the aging process. That could include plastic surgery, a later in life pregnancy, hiring a personal trainer to get in great shape, or trying a dramatic hair color. Flight, in this case, is more akin to denial that the changes are happening and can include reactions like withdrawing from social activities or even symptoms of depression. The symptoms of a female midlife crisis can look like burnout, though. It's worth noting that these are the most stereotypical reactions for modern women, but there are often more psychologically weighty triggers than the physical aging process. After years in the working world, I see women often experience something that looks like burnout combined with boredom, explains Melody Wilding, LMSSW, executive coach and licensed social worker for high-achieving women. We're socialized to get a good job and keep moving up in that job, but what happens when there's no more up to go? It's not so much about wanting to be young and beautiful again, it's about being fully yourself, she says. Wilding says her clients often realize that after years of doing the same high-octane work, they've begun snapping at coworkers, or they feel like they're banging their head against the proverbial wall at work, and that these behaviors don't match to their true personalities or work styles. It's certainly a different kind of crisis, but no less troubling. The early midlife crisis does exist. The kind of crisis Wilding describes is not limited to midlife. It can happen at any time. Women can have a crisis about the meaning of their life as early as their 20s. I'm seeing more people in this age group thinking about the fragility of life and trying to make meaning of theirs. Is that a midlife crisis? I think it's a mid-adult crisis, she says. Wilding says it's not necessarily a bad thing if this happens relatively early in life. There can actually be less pressure because you have time. People see that they have a longer runway to figure something out, like starting a new business. If you're dealing with a midlife crisis, consider seeking help. So if you're experiencing feelings like these, what should you do? Wilding says that if you have more bad days of struggling with these kinds of questions or thoughts than good ones, that's a strong sign that you might want to seek professional help, be it a life coach, a therapist, or a supportive group of friends. Diller agrees. It's like if you're in a traffic circle and you take the very first turn that you see because you're terrified to keep going. You don't want to do that. You want to pause long enough to think carefully about how you can move forward in a productive, vital way. If you try to stop the aging process, it's a losing battle. Crisis turns into resolution, I think, when people find balance and manage their feelings around aging by accepting that we all get older. Why I did and didn't name my daughter Ruth after Justice Ginsburg. She Will Grow Knowing the Power and Legacy of Her Name by Lee Carroll. This article was published on September 25th, 2020. When the doctor told me I was having a girl, I said to my husband, "She'll be named Joan or Ruth." At 10 weeks pregnant, I was unsure of everything except that. Joan or Ruth? "Don't you think everyone will think we named her after Ruth Bader Ginsburg?" my husband asked. Justice Ginsburg at that point was well into her years as a pop feminist icon, the notorious RBG, and he worried the significance of naming our daughter after my grandmother, also Ruth, might be lost. "I think I prefer Joan," he said. "We named her Ruth." In Hebrew, Ruth means friend, so I reasoned my Ruth would be fine having two namesakes. The first was my grandmother, Ruth Goldman, who died at 90 years old, the year before I got pregnant in 2018. The second would be Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who died last Friday. I found out about Ginsburg's death from a ping on my phone, a news alert, and then ping after ping after ping. It was my friends texting me, in group chats, in DMs. We were women devastated by the loss, terrified for what it might mean, mourning collectively on our tiny screens. Ruth Bader Ginsburg hadn't always been the rock star of jurisprudence we know her as now. When she was nominated by President Clinton in 1993, there were many who thought she was an overly conservative pick. In the past, she'd criticized the Roe v. Wade decision, not because she didn't support a woman's bodily autonomy. She did. But because she felt the ruling stalled a growing movement for abortion rights and was centered around the physician instead of individual women. As a junior member of the court, she didn't take on many of the flashiest cases, even in the case that would make her famous. Ledbetter versus Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company wasn't the most exciting on the 2007 docket, but when the majority ruled against Lilly Ledbetter, deciding that she was not entitled to back pay after discovering she'd been paid significantly less than male colleagues for years, Ginsburg donned her dissenting collar and read the minority decision aloud. An unusual move at that time. "In our view," she said, "the court does not comprehend or is indifferent to the insidious way in which women can be victims of pay discriminations." She was speaking on behalf of the three other judges in the minority, but she was also describing herself. She was the only woman on the Supreme Court following Sandra Day O'Connor's resignation, and she'd been one of the only 9 women in her graduating law school class of 1959. And she'd been demoted by the U.S. Army when she told them she was pregnant. Ginsburg's point was both larger and more personal. How can a man know what it's like to be a woman in the workplace? Or, for that matter, the world? As the news of her death sunk in, my mind went to my first Ruth, my beloved Grammy, a Jewish woman who faced down adversity, worked for 50 years as a bookkeeper at a costume jewelry manufacturer, and was the sole breadwinner for her family. Her name had been Joan. And then I thought about my second Ruth, 16 months old, my silly string bean, a ham like her great-grandmother already. Her favorite words were Dada, Nona, our dog Mona, and No. No is the best of these words, because Ruthie understands it in a kind of existential way that I relate to deeply. Yesterday she was having a snack, and when she realized her bowl of puffs was nearly empty, she held it close to her face and whispered, No, 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 no. Like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Ruthie understands the importance of dissent. Like Ruth Goldman, she understands that happiness, a snack, or, in my Grammy's case, a decisive victory in duplicate bridge, must be celebrated even though, inevitably, it ends. I have realized halfway through writing this very essay that all of this is not about the decision to name my daughter after two wonderful women. It's about the decision I made not to name her after my mother, Joan. It's a decision I confronted with Justice Ginsburg's death, and one I'm admitting to now for the first time. I'm admitting I worry that if I named my daughter Joan, she might end up like Joan. Joan Goldman Carroll was smart and kind, a mother and a crusader for what she felt was right. She was also, in her final months, drug addicted, a survival sex worker, and a woman who must have felt very alone and very afraid in a society that offered her no recourse, only scorn. In October of 1984, shortly after I turned 4 years old, my mother, grandmother, and I went to Temple. For a jovial holiday in which children can participate that follows the solemnity of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. That night after services, my mother left me with my grandmother Ruth. She went with two of her drug dealers to a hotel room, and they strangled her to death. They did it, one of them later told the police, because they thought she might be a narcotics informer. But also, he added, they killed my mother Joan because they decided she was a real promiscuous piece of shit on account of she had a daughter. I was, am, of course, that daughter. And sometimes now when I'm holding Ruthie, when we're cuddled up and reading, or when she's in the bath so small and vulnerable, my string bean, I look her in the eyes and I tell her, I will love you forever. I will never, ever stop loving you. And to myself, I think, what if this is it? What if you only have two more years to love her before something happens to you? And that is part of the reason I did not name her Joan. Her name for me is bound up with sorrow and loss and overshadowed by the manner of her death. And I'm furious that the men who killed her hold any power over the decisions I make as a mother. I thought about these men and what they did to my mother and to my grandmother and to me, the trauma and horror they dropped into our lives that continues to this day, while watching Brett Kavanaugh pounding his fist, red-faced, telling Congress that the judicial nominee process was a farce. I thought about how men and women seem to interpret his aggression differently. I thought about Trump, saying it was a very dangerous time to be a man. And like so many other people, I cried. I cried out of frustration, and I cried because just as Ginsburg had pointed out that a man could never know what it was like to be a woman in the workplace, those in power would never understand what it was like to feel powerless to the whims of powerful men. After Ginsburg's death, I found out something else about her name. She'd been born Joan Ruth Bader, taking on Ruth when she entered high school. Before everything, she was Joan Ruth Bader, my mother's name, my grandmother's name, my daughter's name, and the name my daughter might have had if I'd been a bit braver and a bit less superstitious. Okay, shifting gears a little bit, here's an article called What It Was Like Registering to Vote for the First Time as a Latina Immigrant. This article is by Mariana Atencio. Voting is a privilege that not one of us should take for granted. I should know. After escaping political and economic turmoil in Venezuela more than a decade ago, I finally became a U.S. citizen this year. I left my home country because I wasn't going to be able to work as a journalist, which has always been my dream. Along with the loss of freedom for the press, Venezuela's democracy shattered, and one of the catalysts of the crisis was a lack of trust at the ballot box. Back then, I was a college student, fighting for our freedoms by participating in street protest. But authoritarianism was growing by the day as politicians like Hugo Chavez and then Nicolas Maduro began taking over private properties, closing independent media, mismanaging revenue from the oil industry, and changing the constitution. I quickly realized that there was little I or any other activist could achieve with protest if our votes didn't count for anything. I was lucky to be able to leave in 2008, but fast forward to 2020, and many Venezuelans are now starving and don't have adequate medical care in an oil-rich nation. Now, as a Latina journalist in the U.S. who witnessed the dissolution of her native country, I feel obligated to do whatever I can to help to lead Americans through representation in the media. In the wake of COVID-19, there is a parallel epidemic of authoritarian and repressive systems that could reshape our lives for decades to come, much like they did in Venezuela. So I want to sound the alarm before it's too late. For me, the best way to do that is through honest, credible storytelling and visibility at the ballot box. In my journey to get more people to use their right to be civically engaged, or at least vote, perhaps my biggest obstacle is getting them to see that the future of this country is not about red or blue. In fact, it's more like a chess game, where the white pieces still have an inherent advantage and the black ones have to wait to make their move. My biggest goal is to inspire people of color to be more active in thinking about what's best for their communities instead of hanging on to the same views, labels, or policies that previous generations did. For example, when a politician in Florida uses the words communism or socialism to instill fear in immigrants and their families who suffered through left-wing dictatorships in Latin America, like I did, it's purely strategy. Because those same politicians will then refuse to vote for temporary protected status, or TPS, for the refugees of those same communities. It's the most damaging form of hypocrisy. So, instead of simply trusting politicians who use the right buzzwords because they need our votes, we need to educate ourselves and pay attention and make these officials work for our votes instead of just giving it to them. I know, it sounds overwhelming. But the easiest place to begin is simply by voting, because that's where we have the most power. The Latin community surpassed 60 million people in 2020. That's more than 18% of the U.S. population. Every 30 seconds, a Latino turns 18 and becomes eligible to vote, which means there's the potential for at least 800,000 new Hispanic voters every year, according to the Pew Research Center. The Latino vote has been referred to as the sleeping giant, but in my opinion, mainstream media keeps missing the mark. We're not all sleeping. Many Latinos are already woke. One of the most remarkable shakeups that came out of the Black Lives Matter movement this summer was a sharp increase in Latinx voter registration. The organization Voto Latino, where I serve on the leadership council, has seen a 2,750% jump in Latinx voter registration since the killing of George Floyd. This goes to show that many Latinx and African American communities bonded over the mutual suffering of being disproportionately affected by police brutality and felt compelled to take action. Still, politicians are still trying to reach the sleeping giant, but it seems they have a hard time understanding how many layers there are in Latino communities. We are extremely diverse in countries of origin, multicultural upbringings, and political beliefs. Politicians have a hard time understanding these nuances and try to reach us as a monolith, but end in a lose-lose scenario in every election. Frankly, I'm fed up with waiting on them to understand our diversity, contributions, and impact. It is up to us to represent and lead our own people. I became a U.S. citizen this past Valentine's Day, on one of the last in-person naturalization ceremonies before the pandemic. And on September 3rd, before I headed to the Miami-Dade County Elections Office to register to vote for the first time, I decided not to do it alone. I met up with three passionate Gen Zers, 18-year-old twins Sophie and Olivia Kish and Sophia Barreto, all Latinas that I met through mutual friends. We went to register together, face mask and all. It was incredible to see the next generation so engaged. Could we have done it online? Sure. But we wanted to feel the weight of the moment in person. Filling out the voter registration form by hand felt exciting. I'm such a nerd. But I can't begin to describe the feeling of accomplishment I felt when checking the first box. Are you a citizen of the United States of America? I only wished my parents had been there to see me, because they sacrificed so much for me to get through those doors, and I know they would have been proud. After I left, I felt very much American. Being able to choose my elected officials, it felt like I belonged, like I had completed this long journey and I was finally home. It will all come full circle when I vote in person in Miami on November 3rd. All right, this next article is called Uncle Ben's is Changing Its Name to Ben's Original. You can expect to see the new packaging in 2021, and this article is by Kristen Salaki. The photo shows the box of Uncle Ben's Rice, and the logo on the box is a photo of an African-American man with a bow tie. Next to his face, it says perfect every time. And underneath that, it says Uncle Ben's. Around 3 months after an announcement that it would evolve the Uncle Ben's name and branding, Mars Incorporated has officially said that the Rice brand will now be known as Ben's Original. In a press release about the new name, Mars said the change is signaling the brand's ambition to create a more inclusive future while maintaining its commitment to producing the world's best rice. They also confirmed in the release that the logo will also be removed, but did not immediately clarify what it will look like or if there will be another image in its place. Over the last several weeks, we have listened to thousands of consumers, our own associates, and other stakeholders from around the world, Global President Mars Food, Multisales, and Global Customers Fiona Dawson said. We understand the inequities that are associated with the name and the face of the previous brand, and as we announced in June, we have committed to change. The Uncle Ben's name and logo have been criticized for its imagery, as well as of the racist origins of its name. According to the New York Times, white Southerners once used uncle and aunt as honorifics for older blacks because they refused to say Mr. and Mrs. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. Be sure to listen next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ann Jordan, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.